Joining us right now on PMP Network is Mike Walker. You know him and love him from the National Enquirer. He is a number one New York Times best-selling author, and he has written a great book. It's called Out for Blood, The Private Diary of a Gossip Vampire. And, of course, gossip columnists have been called vampires before, but this is a literal one. And I want to ask you right off the bat, Mike. By the way, welcome to PMP Network.
Thank you, Mark.
There's a comment in here that I wanted to ask you about. And, of course, I'm not going to be able to find it now. That's the way things work here. But where is it? Oh, here it is. Yeah. I thought was a really cool quote here. In the book, the vampire mentions this. Says, even gossip columnists have principles. Well, the good ones anyway, who are artfully filthy and funny, but always fair, cutting but never cruel. That's why all but a handful crash and burn. Do you kind of believe that?
Yeah, I do. I get lots of comments from readers who say things like, what I like about your column is you can be snarky, you can be tough, but you also are fair, and you also say nice things about stars where they're due. I think somebody who's, you know, just one way, you remember back in the early days, we had remember Joe Pine, people like that, who just, you know, Johnny One Note, you know, everything is nasty, everything's mean, everything's snarky. I tried to just keep a balance. I mean, I just find that it's sort of my own personality. I think that's what a columnist always has to be. It has to be your own, you know, personality shining through. When I was a reporter, obviously, my personality did not shine through. I was supposed to just write things neutrally. But when I became a columnist, I realized very quickly it was a different thing. And people were interested in me. Not me per se, but you know, the person who writes the column. And they get very intrigued by your personality and how you're going to think about certain things.
That's correct.
And by the way, I'm making myself sound too nice. I mean, I'm not bending over backwards to be a nice guy. I don't mean that at all. I just mean that, you know, fair is fair. I mean, even stars do good things, they do bad things, but you know, Hollywood is a town where there are no secrets from somebody like me. And I try to be judicious in how I dole them out.
Well, it's interesting to note that, and you know, aside from the book here for a minute, I'd love to talk to you about the business you're in, because I've been reading The Enquirer for many, many years, and I really enjoy it, and I enjoy your column. And I assume that you get people, especially publicists, leaking stuff to you to get, you know, promotions for their clients. Sometimes even these, like, sex tapes are leaked out there just to get publicity for people whose careers are kind of flagging, and it gets them going. How do you play that? Are there times where people put something in your lap and you say, I'm not going to do that, I don't want to help this person, or I don't want to, you know, get involved in that?
Pretty much what I always do is use the same values I used as a reporter. You know, number one, is it a story? Number two, is if I'm getting it from somebody, are they trying to play me or telling me something that's phony? I mean, obviously, as a reporter, you have to be very sensitive to the idea, as you just said, of publicists, let's say, for example, come along and they try to sell you a bill of goods that makes their star look good. And conversely, they'll sell you bad stuff about other people's stars. So you always have to be in this position where you have to figure out a way to sort of find out if this is true or could it be true. And if it's not true, obviously, then you can turn the tables on the person and say, look what they tried to do. We have that going all the time. I mean, you know, it's like the Kardashians are classic at that. You know, they concoct stories that are just meaningless to get publicity. I'm not singling them out. I mean, lots of people do that.
Right.
But, you know, they're a good example. And I'm doing an article this week on Harry Styles, you know, the One Direction singer. You've probably heard of him. Good-looking young stud. He's the stud du jour. And the girls all love him. And there was a supposed romance with Kendall Jenner, one of the Kardashian daughters. And it was just completely manufactured. I mean, she was just sort of making it up as she went along. And she had, I mean, she knew Harry Styles, and she was out with him a couple of times, but it was no big romance. They were just trying to build it into that in order to get people like me to write about it and publicize them.
Right.
You know, and fair enough. I mean, that's not anything horrible. But, you know, sometimes it can get, yesterday got a call from a guy who said, I have this really dirty story on this major TV personality. And I'll tell you who it was. Al Roker, he says. This is a scandal. I'm thinking, okay. Al Roker? Al Roker has a scandal? Well, good for him at his age. And so we talked to the guy, and the guy said, here, and I said, okay, so fine, let's cut to the chase here. How do you know this, sir? Are you connected with that show, or are you connected with Al Roker in some way? And he goes, oh, no. He said, I just watch the show every day. I said, and you've sort of intuited all of this scandalous thing from watching Al Roker? You've just decided he's up to something? I mean, it was bizarre.
Well, he must have had tinfoil on his head, that guy.
Oh, my God. And you get, and the trouble is, Mark, as a reporter, you have to follow every one of these up because you never know who is going to suddenly give you something that is like, oh, my God, this is really true. This guy really knows what he's talking about. And that's how big stories break. And you never know where they're coming from.
Now, I assume that you've got burned by a couple people. I've been a columnist since 1998. And I think twice in that time I was given wrong information, which I didn't check because I had relied on the source so much because the person always told me inaccurate stories. But it did explode in my face twice. Had that happened to you at all?
It hasn't happened to me in so many years I can't remember when the last time was, and it was nothing serious. I've always been pretty sensitive to the idea. I mean, I got into this business as a very young kid. And, I'm pretty experienced, and I'm pretty experienced in the ways of writing a column, because even when I was a reporter, what happened was I came back from an assignment that was just a little routine story that suddenly turned into an above-the-fold, front-page story. I was on the front page for 6 days. And if they'd known that, they wouldn't have sent me because I was too junior to be sent to an important story. But suddenly it became an important story. And the editor said, he says, you're really a good writer. He said, because your stuff was coming back, and we weren't even giving it to the rewrite guys. We were just putting it right in the paper. And I said, yeah, I noticed that. Thank you. And he says, you're a good writer, kid. What we should do with you, He says, you're always out in the clubs and everything, running around, dragging in here at, 6 in the morning, right from the nightclubs. Why don't we give you your own column? And I said, my own column? He says, yeah. I mean, I said, with my picture in it and everything? He says, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I said, wow. So I was so excited. I remembered a couple of days later, I forgot to ask if I was getting paid extra for it. I wasn't. And I did this column. I please forgive me again, everyone, for this, the people who are subjected to the name of the column. I called it The Wee Hours with Walker. Oh, God. I mean, but I was a kid, and suddenly I had a column. And I was doing that in addition to my duties as a reporter. And I soon found that I was in love with the column. Because suddenly people were calling me. When you're a columnist, you know this, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
You're a high-profile guy, and people call you. The column, my column in the National Enquirer, is the highest-rated feature in the paper in all age groups by a wide margin, and has been for many years. And that's not me saying it. That's reader polls saying.
Absolutely.
It.
Yep.
So you have a big responsibility. I am so careful about being burned. Now, but the other thing is, if you ever heard me do. I did a thing on Howard Stern's show for years.
And I was going to ask you about that because it's perfect, because people read your thing and they go, oh, come on, that's, that doesn't sound right. And what you did on the Howard Stern show was that you'd come up with a bunch of them. Three of them were actually real stories, which didn't sound real, and one of them was a fake, which usually sounded more real than the other ones.
So, that's what I used to say. I used to say, the point of this game is, and why this game is so fascinating, is truth is stranger than fiction, because everybody would guess, and I think it was this one, and I'd give, as you said, four items. One of them is phony. I've made it up using my skills, to suck you into believing it. And they'd say, oh, this one is the true one, and this one. And so many times, everyone would pick every other item except that one.
That's right.
And I said, that's the thing that this proves to you. Truth is sometimes stranger than fiction.
Yeah, yeah. And talking about fiction, the book is really a lot of fun. And I thought it was really a clever idea to make the gossip guy a vampire.
Well, I just got a very good review from Hits Magazine, the music magazine. And this guy really got it, the reviewer. He says, in a perfect example of fantasy wish fulfillment, Walker turns himself into National Revealers. That's the name of my fictional newspaper, ace reporter Clark Kelly, who just happens to be a 300-year-old card-carrying, blood-sucking member of the undead. And then he goes into, you know, all the things in the book and why it's exciting and why it's good and why he liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, I loved how he ended up. He says, this one literally begs to be made into a movie. Your lips to God's ear, pal. So he got it. In other words, that's what happened. You're right. You know, we're called vampires and worse. And somebody said it to me one day, and it just suddenly resonated. And there's this vampire craze that we've been in the midst of for years now.
Mm-hmm.
You know why there's this vampire craze, don't you?
Actually, don't. I don't understand it because I'm not into it myself. So.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. Here's the quick answer, my friend. Vampires. Why do girls love vampires? My character says at one point, Clark Kelly says, for centuries, vampires struck fear in the hearts of whimpering young maidens. Now we ignite erotic heat in their tummies. Here's what it is. It's real simple. Girls like bad boys.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what vampires represent.
Yeah.
Okay? What girl in their right mind would go near a vampire, right? Girls are supposed to be afraid. Ooh, a little scary. Mm. But they run at vampires.
Well,
and that's sort of what this is all about. And I thought, well, let's take advantage of that. But I really got intrigued by it because I thought, wow, if I was a vampire, man, think of the things I could do. I mean, I could just jump off my balcony here at the Four Seasons in Hollywood and fly, you know, up into the sky and sort of make little stops hovering in the air over, say, Scarlett Johansson's bedroom.
Who, by the way, is in this?
Or Tom Cruise's. Well, see what he's up to.
Scarlett's actually in the book, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting. Your character dies in 1733, and becomes a vampire, after his experience with the Countess. And what I love about it is the fact that by making him a vampire, you've allowed yourself then to go through every era of Hollywood, and
yes,
be a part of it, which I loved it.
I
you know, the fact that you were big pals with James Dean, and then when he passed away, you buried yourself with him, and said you were beneath him, and mentioned I'm not gay though. I love that. I there's a lot of great humor, which is the same humor you show on the Stern Show, and because you know when we listen to you so much, we kind of get to know you a little bit. Plus, reading what you've been writing, I kind of feel like I know you, and your humor comes across really well in the book, which is great.
Well, that's what I get a lot in the reviews. People say it's funny. It's downright funny. Even my vampire makes corny jokes a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about, hey, what if I did a vampire stand-up act? How would that be? Like, I'm a vampire and I do a stand-up act. Yeah, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, or as we like to call you, snacks. You know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And corny stuff. And he says, I know I'm corny, all my vampire, you know, vampires don't have great senses of humor. I'm one of the few who does, but even I realize I fall short, and my vampire friends all say that. I start cracking jokes, and they go, oh, my God, get me out of here. So I built a character who really is someone who is not just a scary guy. He's a guy who he likes, how can I put it? He says, at one point, Clark Kelly, my vampire gossip columnist, says, I had never felt so alive, even when I was alive. and he says things like that all the time, and he says that every time he comes up from you know how vampires go back under the earth and they rest like my character did under the grave of Jimmy Dean for many years. He lay doggo, you know, under the earth, and it renews them. And he said, every time, though, when I come out of the earth, I thank whoever for making me a creature who can fly. Just the idea of flight, that's always intrigued me. The idea that you could fly above the earth and look down on things and go where you want to go, you know, quickly and conveniently, just always fascinated me.
Mm.
And I think that's why the book has been successful. You know, it's funny, and it tells you a lot about human nature, because Clark, for a vampire, is, you know, a pretty human kind of guy. That's how I see him.
And Mike Walker is, for a gossip guy, is a pretty human guy. So I think that there's a little bit of a juxtaposition there. But and Clark Kelly, of course, came from Clark Gable and Gene Kelly.
Gene Kelly, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I went through all those eras of Hollywood. What happened was he eventually, he's 300 years old, and he eventually made his way from Europe. You know, he died in Romania, and was, you know, reborn as a vampire. And, you know, did the usual things, hung around Paris and all of that. But then he came to Hollywood, and he came the first time in the 30s, and he came in the 40s, and he came in the 50s, and it was the different eras. And I was always fascinated by that. And I did a lot of things about stars that I knew about. I do one thing about Lucille Ball. I say that before she was married,
mm-hmm.
he had an affair with her.
Yep.
He said, it's a funny thing. He said, people always ask me this one thing about Lucy. And so I finally asked her. He said, I always get people asking me, you know, she was red-haired. Does the carpet match the drapes? And Lucy mm-hmm. says, I get that all the time. And I'm basing that on something I know about, that, you know, that she was well aware of people speculating on things like that. She was a very funny lady.
Well, you just gave an example of it. That you have in here, I mean, everything in this book is from all the eras. You have everything from Leonardo DiCaprio to Howard Stern in here. That you've been able to kind of mix fact and fiction so well. That I think that's another one of the reasons why it's doing so well and people really enjoy it. It's a very quick read. I actually got it a couple of days ago and just started going through it, and it's very easy to read. So it's fun.
Well, that's a high compliment indeed. Easy to read. I've written, as you said, you know, number one New York Times best-selling author, but that wasn't for fiction. That was for a nonfiction book. That was my book on the O.J. Simpson case, the book that literally stopped the trial. Judge Ito stopped the trial when it came out and said, I have to read this book. And I went, thank you, Judge Ito, because, of course, within a week I was at number one.
Yep.
And I wrote another book on the trial, actually, called Private Diary of an O.J. Juror, about that juror that Johnny Cochran got kicked off the jury, Michael Knox,
mm-hmm.
and did that book. And that did number five on the New York Times bestselling list. But fiction, I'd only done one novel before. And this one, I sat down one day, and I just said, and in fact, I was in the midst of doing a book, a nonfiction book that I'd contracted for, and I said, I don't care. This thing intrigues me, and so I started writing it. I wrote, you know, I don't know, a couple of chapters, and I thought, well, it's not too bad, you know. Finally, I thought, stop thinking about it, and so I just started to write. And what I usually say is, if you get 20,000 words into something, and then you put it aside for a week or two, and then you read it, you know, usually, a lot, not usually, but a lot of times, your reaction, my reaction is, oh, God, you know, what was I thinking? Or it's not a bad idea, but I haven't executed it well. It just isn't for me. But in this one, I just kept going. It just intrigued me. And finally, I stopped looking. I just went, the hell with it. And it was a great thing, because usually when you're writing a book, nonfiction particularly, there are expectations. You know, they're saying, look, we want a lot about how O.J., you know, did this or that. You know, you have the publisher pressuring you, various people pressuring you to put things in that they want, mm-hmm. the way they see the book. This, I consulted with no one. No one knew I was writing this book. I just sat down and I wrote it, and I just decided I am not going to sit down. I'm not going to do my usual planning. I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to sit and write this just the way I feel it, and that's what the book is.
Yeah, and it does come across the way, but it's so much fun, and I'll tell the folks out there why it's so much fun, because every movie star that you've ever heard of from the 1930s and 40s to current is in here. Movies, you've gone through a bunch of movies and take little pieces of the movies and put them in here as well. So
yeah.
People out there that love entertainment, that love this kind of stuff, will really get into this book.
Well, the guy who reviewed it, again, in Hits Magazine, he says, Walker takes us inside the machinations of a gossip tabloid while giving a literally bird's-eye view of Tinseltown, which comes with actual locations like Pomodoro Trattoria in Westwood, noting its delicious thin-crust pizza, Moon Shadows in Malibu, Mel Gibson's one-time favorite hangout, Dominic's on Beverly Boulevard, singing the praises of its female bartender, and then Dupar's at the famous Farmer's Market, a restaurant I love. He says where Walker recommends the Belgian waffles with blueberry sauce, or the vampire recommends, you know,
mm-hmm.
and Wolfgang Puck's, complete with a cameo by Wolfie himself. And that's I took everything that I know and kind of the beat that I run, you know, so that people could sort of see Hollywood a little bit as I see it, as a real place full of real people. I mean, yeah, they're stars, and yeah, they're full of it and all that, but they're just people. and they're interesting. They're, you know, that people are interesting.
They are.
You know, stars are interesting, but people, just people, are interesting themselves on their own level. People sometimes don't understand that. They think of themselves as just boring people who aren't stars. But I've got a great item that I'm going to tell your listeners before I tell anybody else. This isn't even in the column yet. I mean, it's going to be in the column in a few days. But it is one of the funniest stories. It shows how people get hooked into this Hollywood culture. Kirsten Dunst is standing outside Nordstrom's in the Grove. The Grove is that shopping area in Beverly Hills. You often see, like, Extra, the TV show films their stuff from there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a hangout. People go there. It's now become almost like a tourist attraction. So Kirsten Dunst is standing outside Nordstrom's, and this lady comes up with a teenage daughter in tow, and she says, "Oh my God, Kirsten Dunst! Oh my God, would you pose for a photo with us, please?" So Kirsten says, "Sure, I will. Absolutely, very nice." And she posed with them. And the woman says, "You know, my daughter wants to be an actress too. This girl's about like 15 or something, 16. Mm-hmm. And you know, how do you do that?" And Kirsten says, "Well, it's very complicated." She said, "You just have to really, really apply yourself, get a good manager, blah blah blah." And then she says to the girl, being nice, she says, "Well, listen, hey, you know, you're already prettier than I am, so you should do well," which is a nice thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
So the woman says, "Oh, thank you so much. You've been so wonderful, and it's so wonderful meeting you." And Chris says, "Oh, not at all." The woman reaches out, like, shakes her hand, and tucks a $20 bill into Kirsten Dunst's hand and starts walking away. And Kirsten goes, hey, lady, whoa, what are you doing? You have to pay me." And the woman gets all embarrassed. She goes, "Well, I'm sorry. We just came from Hollywood Boulevard where, you know, we had to pay, you know, the Marilyn Monroe impersonator and the Batman impersonator and the Superman impersonator and you know how those impersonators stand outside on Hollywood Boulevard, and they want $20 for posing for a photo." So she said, "I just thought it was sort of a norm here in Hollywood." That shows how Hollywood can suck you in.
I guess so. That's funny. The fact that you've been doing this for so long and are so recognizable, your voice, your face from the column, from all the things you do on and I know that the National Enquirer had a TV show for a while you were on. I mean, because I was watching. I used to watch it. I loved it. I loved that show.
Thank you.
So you've become a star in your own right. And how does that affect? Have anybody tried to do gossip on you? Have you ended up in anybody else's columns?
Yeah, I've ended up in columns, but never with anything scandalous or shocking. Even my wife used to say to me, she used to say, "Don't forget. Don't be fooling around with girls when you're out there, because everybody would just love to get the gossip editor of the National Enquirer in their spotlight." You know,
it's true. It's actually unfortunately true for you. That is true.
Well, it is true. Yes, and I remember that. I remember one night. I remember this vividly. I was in the Four Seasons in L.A. and I was sitting in one of the booths, and a whole bunch of us, you know, probably 15 people there, most of whom I knew. And I was sitting there, and I suddenly realized there was this very attractive young girl sitting next to me. And, I mean, I knew her a little bit. She was an actress. And I suddenly realized I had my arm not around her, but, like, on the top of the booth.
Right, where it would appear that way.
Yeah, if you took a picture. Mm-hmm. Believe me, if Mike Walker took a picture of you, there you go. See that hand? You know.
Mm-hmm.
So I just carefully withdrew my hand. You know why? I told my wife about it. I said, "I just saw your face. You know, your face just appeared in the Four Seasons, hovering above me." You know, no, I've never had anything really scandalous about me. I've been mentioned in gossip columns, but usually, the last time I was really anything resembling a scandal was I don't know if you remember this. It was in all the papers. Alec Baldwin was doing an interview with the Times of London. He's in London doing an interview. And the guy happened to ask him, "What do you think of Mike Walker?" You know, the National Enquirer, mm-hmm. gossip columnist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Baldwin was a journalist. And he goes, "Mike Walker, that guy is..." I'm looking for the quote here. I don't have it in front of me. It was just hilarious. "That guy is a wheezing, goat-footed queen." Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, and he went on a little bit more, and so what I did was and the guy said, well, why are you so angry at him? He says, well, he once said that I had an argument with Tina Fey, and I never argue with Tina, which is absolute crap. Everybody knows Alec Baldwin knows he has arguments with everybody. But and it wasn't, you know, nasty or anything. That's what got me. You know, I said, Jesus, guy's so thin-skinned. So anyway, what I did was I used another gossip columnist to help me out with this. I wrote an item, you know, to respond to Alec Baldwin. Mm-hmm. And then I called Richard Johnson, who was the head of then. He was the head of Page Six. Richard now is back with the New York Post again as the man who knows New York. He has a column again.
Mm-hmm.
But in those days, you remember Page Six. I mean, it was
sure.
A powerful gossip columnist. So, a gossip columnist. So I called Richard, who I've known for 1,000 years. And I said, hey, I don't know if you'd be interested in this, but... And he said, yeah, I heard Baldwin called you a queen, man. What the hell? And I said, yeah, my wife thinks it's hilarious. She said, I didn't know you were gay, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote this item, and I wrote it, I think, very cleverly. What's the worst thing you can call a Hollywood liberal actor? Anti-gay, right? Because
mm-hmm.
in Hollywood, saying you're anti-gay mm-hmm. with the, you know, the liberal yeah. mindset out there, it's like, what? You know, it's mm-hmm. a horrible thing to call someone. So my item said something like, gather ye torches and your pitchforks, Hollywood, the monster lurks among ye. And then I did the item about how Baldwin had called me a goat-footed queen. And so Richard said, oh, my God, let me call him and tell him. I said, good, do whatever you want. So he calls Baldwin. He had once had a feud with Baldwin. They made up. Uh-huh. He called Baldwin. He said, Mike Walker is going to do an item, and I have it. Want to hear it? Baldwin was, yeah. So he did the item, and Baldwin quickly realized that I'd hit him right in the, you know, to mm-hmm. call him an idiot or a moron, or that would have been one thing, but to yeah. call him anti-gay,
uh-huh.
you know, a yep. homophobe.
Yep.
And you know, you've probably been reading about how Alec is reacting to that, saying, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't know this horrible term that I called this photographer was an anti-gay comment. Like, yeah, sure you didn't, mm-hmm. buddy. So anyway... Richard calls him up and he reads the item to him. Alec was very smart. What he did was he said, well, this is ridiculous. The idea that I'm a homophobe is ridiculous. And all my gay male lovers agree with me. That was a quote. And that was very clever. You know, uh-huh. he sort of turned it around.
Yeah.
So it ended with kind of a ha-ha-ho-ho.
Yeah.
But everybody kept asking me, by the way, if you know Alec Baldwin's character, it was hilarious. People were asking me, what does he mean, goat-footed queen? What the hell does that mean? And I said, you know, it's very important for Alec to always appear as if he's erudite. He's always trying to sort of act as if he's very well-versed in the language and well-read and et cetera. I said, what he meant to say was cloven-hoofed.
Yeah.
The best he could do was goat-footed. And everyone went, all right.
Oh, that's pretty funny. Well, you know, we've just run out of time, actually. And we have Mike Walker here. The book is called Out for Blood, Private Diary of a Gossip Vampire. And it's a great book. You should pick it up.
Yeah, look from, at the reviews on Amazon. I'm 4.6 out of 5 stars.
Very good.
Good.
TWCS Publishing House puts it out, by the way. And I should mention that in this interview, we actually got an exclusive that Mike didn't even realize that he revealed. So that's what happens when you're a columnist. You hear things. When you've been doing interviews since you were 9 years old, you hear things. Now, he was talking. Mike was talking about Richard Johnson, and he said, quote, I've known him for 1,000 years, which confirms that Mike actually is a vampire.
Oh, my God, no.
You are outed. You are outed.
Mark, you're being ridiculous, Mark.
No, and you know it.
I am
now,
not
see,
a vampire.
We now know that the truth. Of the matter. Mike, it was a pleasure to have you on the show, and I understand that actually you are from this area, from Massachusetts.
Yeah, I was born in Southie, and I worked down on the Cape in the summertime. What was it called? Manomet?
Manomet,
Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's in Plymouth area there. Right?
Yep, in the Plymouth area. Yep. And we lived in Southie, and then my father, who was a naval officer, retired, and he did what naval officers always do. He's a captain of a ship. He bought a chicken farm in Plimpton, Massachusetts. You ever hear of Plimpton?
I have, yeah.
A little tiny town, and my father bought a farm. It was really funny to go from the neighborhoods of Southie to 140 acres in Plimpton, Massachusetts is really something.
And by the way, I should tell you, as now a new resident of the Cape, we don't consider Plymouth the Cape. Only after the bridge is considered the Cape.
Oh, after the bridge. Oh,
yeah.
Pardon me.
Yeah,
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 I
over,
remember all that.
You have to go. You have to go over the bridge. If you're not over the bridge, you're not on the Cape. So that's the way it is. Mike,
well,
it was a pleasure.
I made you run out of time. As my wife would say, you made the classic mistake, Mark. You asked him a question. Don't ask him a question. We'll be here all night.
No, I really enjoy talking to you. In fact, you know, I'd love to be off the air and gossip with you because I enjoy that. But
well,
it was
buddy, we will.
A pleasure talking to you, Mike.
Pleasure talking to you, my
Take
friend.
Take care. Bye-bye.